using that self-consistency way of arguing, the strings generate the quanta of these fields. We then prepare a background out of these fields and ask the string if it likes to propagate, and it says yes, providing they satisfy Einstein's equations and coupled to other stuff. And so, just as a side remark, that's one of the remarkable things about string theory that nobody really understands, but it's great. You ask the string you just sit down and write down that you want this relativistic object, which is extended, and that it be quantum mechanical, and it comes back and says, okay, I'll agree to exist, but only if you allow me to describe gravity. And that's sort of an unexpected bonus of the theory, because we were looking for such a theory. But no one knows why. No one knows what the deep principle is. Maybe one of you folks will find it for us, because that clearly is going to teach us a lot if we could really understand why strings like to describe gravity. Anyway, I'm off the off topic here. I wanted to look at a number of things, again, structurally, that we should be able to identify with our experienced eyes when we come to look at products of string theory. And one of them was the fact that in string frame, this is already telling you that you were working at string tree level, because this e to the minus 2 phi implies, point by point, it implies g string to the minus 2. G string to the minus 2 is the sphere in perturbation theory. And then I realized that I should, at this point, formalize that piece of the language. What do people mean when they say the sphere? Why are they referring to the sphere? Well, this is just the reminder that we have a number of things we can do here, because we have that freedom to choose that conformal factor when we were playing around with the world sheet metric. So what we can always do is choose a conformal factor to map a typical, this would be a typical string process where, say, I have three closed strings, and I can always choose my conformal factor, because remember, I can do that locally, so as to map everything to something which has the topology of the sphere, which is three points where all the quanta of those external string states have been mapped into things called vertex operators. So that's a piece of technology that I won't tell you about in any detail, except to say that it is not unreasonable that you can do that in view of the fact that we can choose that conformal factor. So, so this is tree level diagram. Obviously, there's no loops, and so there's it's the sphere. And similarly for the and so there's the G string to the minus two factor. And similarly for the disk, and we'll talk more about open string perturbation theory later on. And the operators there are on the boundary. So then I sort of briefly mentioned the fact that we have a nice organization in terms of various diagrams, the sphere, the torus, the disk, the cylinder, and later higher orders, or mixing in orders when you have unoriented strings as well, which I'll talk about later on. Okay, so then I talked about going from the string frame to the Einstein frame. I won't repeat that. I think I did say everything I wanted to say there. And crucially, we have Newton's constant. Makes most sense in that frame. And then, yes, so the last thing I wanted to say was that everything I just said for the closed strings, I can do essentially the same thing for the open strings. Let me just focus for now on the case where I have all Neumann boundary conditions. My background field, this is the field that's created by this quanta of the strings, as we've seen. Sorry, the string, this is the field whose quanta are created by the fluctuations of the open strings with Neumann boundary conditions, a field in space-time which we identify with the photon. It has a U1 gauge invariance. And you can couple that at the world sheet level to the boundary with an interaction, something like that. And at the end of the day, the space-time action that you deduce by studying that particular model is essentially Well, it's something like Maxwell's action. I shouldn't really have a trace there. It's something like Maxwell's action, except there's an e to the minus phi there. And that e to the minus phi is exactly where it should be, because that's open string tree level, and that would be g string to the minus 1. So indeed, we have everything making sense. And there's some constant out there that we'll talk about later on. And right, so this is where I mentioned perturbation theory is really not, it's really g string to the minus chi, where chi is now 2 minus 2h minus b, where b is the number of boundaries if I have open string sectors. OK, so as you know, or if you don't, that's OK, because this is where we're going. There's a much more geometrical language to describe the setup. Remember, we'd also like to have not just Neumann boundary conditions on both ends, but perhaps Dirichlet boundary conditions on both ends, or perhaps mixed Dirichlet boundary. And there'll be different sectors depending upon how complicated we want to get. And at the end of the day, the nice way of visualizing all of that is to use the language of D-brains. And we'll talk a lot more about that. So D-brains are just hypersurfaces describing everything I just said in a nice geometrical way. I have, say, this dark blue object being the D-brain, and I have open string sectors transverse to the brain, so directions in which I move away from the blue hypersurface if I have a Dirichlet coordinate in there, a Dirichlet boundary condition that tells me where the string ends should be, and then they can move around in the blue hypersurface. Those are Neumann directions. And so that very naturally lends itself to being described as just a simple hypersurface within a larger within the larger space-time. And so if it has p extended directions, it's called a dp brain. And so that's how many Neumann directions you have, how many Dirichlet directions. So we'll talk a lot more about this language later on. I will repeat several of these things later on. So let me not talk too much about this. This is just to anticipate where we're going and some of the geometrical language that makes things a lot more clear. So what I'm going to do at this point is stop with the pictures, and we're going to stop now and essentially redo everything we've done. But now we're going to start with constructing superstrings, supersymmetric strings. So these notes I've now given a copy of them to Rob Myers, and so he'll probably put something on the web pointing to a copy of these for those of you who want to quickly review some of those concepts. Yes. Oh, so What you do typically is you then work. You're asking whether how do I include higher order in alpha primed? I've really truncated to. I think this is what you're asking. Tell me if it's not. I really truncated to leading order in alpha primed. I just study the massless modes. Then what about the other stuff? So the higher string modes typically are included by asking how they come in as corrections to the alpha primed equals zero limit. And so what they do is they simply correct, they give you higher order in alpha prime corrections to the space-time field equations. So they give you, for example, higher derivative terms in the effective, in the low energy effective action. And then you can develop just as you would in any effective field theory set of techniques, you can develop a power series in alpha primed where you successively take into account more of those higher order terms, those massive fields. Does that make sense? And so you get, for example, you can build You can build all sorts of things in space-time which correspond to, for example, various powers of the curvature invariance contributing. Because those are allowed by the symmetry, and the string theory will build them for you. And so there's a natural way in which those higher-order curvature theories that people play with phenomenologically, some of those have a natural home in string theory as higher-order corrections coming from the fact that strings describe more than just massless fields. They describe all of those massive fields as well. So that's the logic of how it would work. In general, you don't develop a power series in alpha primed. You simply define the full conformal field theory, that contains, in principle, everything about the background. When you restrict to small alpha primed and develop this leading order piece and then the higher order parts, you're implicitly saying there's some limit in which I can make sense of having some nice smooth background about which I then develop my story. But there are very well-known examples of string theories which are perfectly well-defined, which have no space-time, no smooth space-time interpretation. You simply take the full conformal field theory to define it. And so that includes all of the fields in one fell swoop. So I'm not sure if any of the upcoming courses will talk about that type of technology, but it's out there. Okay, so let's kill this. Is the board actually visible? Is it lit appropriately? Okay. So we could just leave a picture of a brain up there. Okay. So let's take a step back and go ahead and try and build up the language of the supersymmetric strings. So it'll be a while before we get back to talking about the nice blue shiny objects up there, but we will. Any luck? So what I need to do first is go right back to where we were at the very beginning yesterday, or almost at the very beginning. I will start out, but actually start in conformal gauge in defining my world sheet action. So I could start a little bit earlier in the development and then work out the conformal gauge, etc. But I won't do that. I'll just start in conformal gauge. And so this is super supersymmetric strings. So consider the following action. So much the same as what we had yesterday, start out with. I'm starting in conformal gauge, and okay, let me. So my first question to you is whether this writing is large enough. So the fact that I heard no response may mean that the microphone isn't connected and the lights aren't on and I'm not here. And so is it okay? Right at the back? Excellent. Okay. Good. So so what I've done, I've then started again from this two-dimensional perspective. I've switched off. I'm just working in Minkowski space, target space. So I'm just being really sloppy about the indices because I don't need to worry about g mu nu. I've gone to conformal gauge, and I've done a couple of other things which I need to remind you of. So previously I had d2 sigma, which was d tau d sigma, where sigma and tau
went
like that, and then I had sigma 1, sigma 2 being equal to tau and sigma. And this is what I use for an open string. And the conventions I had last time, which ended up in the normalization of my zero modes, was that I had this between 0 and 2 pi for a closed string. So I'll be keeping that convention. So, but I'm using a coordinate z. Z. What do you say in Canada? Oh, excellent. Okay. So I'm using a coordinate z instead of... So I'm using z and z bar, and I've traded those in by defining z equals e to the tau minus I sigma. So this is the well-known exponential map. Exponential map, which takes the, for example, the cylinder upon which the closed string is defined and maps it to the complex plane. Thus. I get a Jacobian for doing that, a Jacobian that looks like z squared or something when I go from this measure to this measure, but that's okay because I can always soak that up by redefining my conformal factor, so everything's fine. Okay, so that's our starting point, and what I've done is I've added in some fermions, and you can always left and right moving, there's d and d bar. D and d bar correspond to d plus and d minus in the previous language that I was using before. The string tension is still 1 over 2 pi alpha primed. So everything's the same except I've added in these fermions. Remember, alpha primed was rather like a world sheet H bar, so this alpha primed here is in the right place. That's very formal. I could always reabsorb that into my definition of the size, but I like to have it explicit. Okay, so this is rather like how we started last time. So we just added in these fermions. So what we get to do is the same set of manipulations as last time. We defined various important quantities. We expanded everything into the modes. And we just sort of expanded a lot of things. So I'm going to do the same thing. So let me remind you, because I will probably need it. So we had things like x, mu, z, and z bar. So now what I'm doing is, rather than in terms of sigma plus and sigma minus, I have everything in terms of z and z bar, left and right moving pieces. And so you can work out what those will look like. And it'll be much the same as what we had yesterday, with some slight modifications. So let me write it out just once and for all. You agree to keep it in your notes so that I can refer to it without having to write it again. So there's something for the left moving piece, something similar for the right moving piece. So same stuff, alpha tilde, Okay, so I've taken the liberty of defining both an alpha 0 and an alpha tilde 0, which I probably didn't do last time. But that's okay. At the end of the day, x mu is still center of mass position, and p mu is center of mass momentum, and this fellow is in fact related to the other guys by 1 over 2 root 2 alpha primed alpha 0 mu plus alpha tilde 0 mu. So for most things, it won't matter that I've defined these two guys differently. I could just give them the same name and put in the factor of 2. But it will when we come to do t-duality, so I want to have them separate. So far we've done nothing new. I'm just writing down some familiar things. So now, when we come to write the stress tensor of the theory, we actually have two pieces, what I'll call a bosonic piece and a fermionic piece. So in this language, the bosonic piece has the first part that should be familiar from before. Just looking at the holomorphic direction. But then there's an additional piece coming from product of fermion pieces, which is also bosonic. And there's a similar thing for what we would call T bar of Z bar, also bosonic. I won't write that out, just stick bars and tildes on everything, or on the fermion tildes. And then there's a fermionic piece, which I'll call TF, which goes like the following expression. And then there's a piece like that. Okay, so the logic of what we're going to do is what we did before, which is just now expand everything out and work in terms of the modes and impose the Virasoro constraints, etc., except we're going to have super Virasoro algebra. The super, I keep saying, right now is all just on the world sheet. We have to work hard to get space-time supersymmetry, and we'll get to that in a moment. So I need some mode expansions for the fermions before I proceed. And this is where we have to be careful, because there's some choices we get to make in defining our fermions. So we need to consider two sectors for the fermions. And the point is, are they periodic or antiperiodic? And if they're periodic, we're in what's called the Ramon sector. And if they're antiperiodic, we're in the Navier-Schwartz sector. Okay, and so that will give us different mode expansions, which we have to keep track of every time we study the calculus of building the string modes. So in particular, I'll have something like psi, hang on a sec. That's not right. Yes. Psi mu of z is equal to a mode expansion that looks something like this. So R is integer if we're in the Ramon sector, and it's half integer if we're in the Nova Short sector. I've only written I've actually done a doubling trick here, which is a sort of well-known thing in this corner of the story. What we're going to do to make this expression make sense is just define everything for. So let me just mention it parenthetically. A doubling trick to sort of mean that we only do half the work, if that makes sense. So we have sigma between 0 and pi for open, as I said. And so what we can do is we can just use a single psi, mu, and so whenever we want to ask what's going on for psi tilde, so this psi nu on this range, sigma tau on 0, sigma 2 pi. I'll clean that up in a moment. Sorry about that. And so we recover this as the following. Sigma tau is equal to psi, the same psi, as follows. So I'll just clean up that equation and say it in a coherent sentence. As follows. So what I do is I simply, right now what I'm going to do is just work as though I'm doing the open string, because later on I can always build the closed string by essentially taking two copies of the story and tensoring them together with the right boundary conditions. I'll say that a little bit more clearly later on. So I really should be working with this range. But what I'll do is I'll extend my discussion to sigma between 0 and 2 pi, and just have a single copy of psi, so I can always get the left moving from the right moving piece by just looking on the other half of the extension, so 2 pi minus sigma, same tau, just I'm playing with extending sigma, so that I've unfolded sigma to pi into sigma to 2 pi. So I hope that makes sense, because then I can define my boundary conditions on that extended range as follows. So this is why I only wrote this down for one direction. Are there any questions about that? Okay, so that's just a notational convenience. It allows me to define these sectors in one go. So having defined these modes, I then have, so this is very much the analog of this stuff. So now I can build everything. So what I need to do is write down my canonical commutation relations and do the quantum mechanical story we had last time. So we then work everything out in terms of commutators and now anti-commutators of the various modes. And those look like the following. So I have some anticommutators for size, and these will, of course, amount to an independent set of anticommutators for the psi tildes, and these will look like e to mu nu delta r plus s. And then similar, what we had last time for the alphas, of course, doesn't change. And the zero modes. Okay, so that will be, from that, everything will follow, because now we can expand these guys out. So I can take the bosonic T's and form the L's, just as I did before. So we have T bosonic is going to look like that's what it'll amount to. That the state, the Fourier expansion I had yesterday, if you go look at that again and convert using the exponential map I defined over there, it will turn into this Laurent expansion, which looks like this. So it's the same thing as before. M goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and this defines for us the LMs, which I will write out in a minute. But now I have an additional sector, which is the fermionic piece. And I'm going to call its Fourier, Laurent coefficients L, sorry, G. And it turns out that it looks like that. And so I'm going to get an algebra. This algebra here will imply some algebra for the commutation relations of the L's and the anti-commutation relations of the G's. So I'm just going to write that out for you. Because we will, this the structure of this algebra will guide us in constructing space-time, the space-time physics that we care about. So what we have is Ln, Lm, is equal to m minus n l n plus m, as before, plus the central term, c over 12 m cubed minus m n plus n, as before. So that's what we had yesterday. But now we have this additional sector, and this turns out to be as follows. And L M G that's G plus R there. OK, I put a zero here because if you're in the Ramon sector, this is if these expressions are true in general, Ramon, Donovan, Schwartz, there's a zero there if, that, if it's Ramon. So we go through and we would work out what these G's are in terms of the alphas and the psi's. And I think I need those, so I will write them out one time as well. And then we're ready to construct space-time physics. So there are several steps that I'm missing out here in terms of actually doing some of this algebra, and none of it's actually very hard. So you should put in the extra time to have a go. And there are various conformal field theory sources that are well known, I can happily recommend some of them for you. So my normal ordered expression for the L's start out again as they did yesterday, but then there's some additional pieces. This chalk really goes incredibly fast. There's some additional pieces. So there's a quarter 2r minus m psi m minus r dot psi r. And then there's that constant a, the analog of the constant we had last time, which I will discuss in a moment. And then g is alpha n dotted with psi r minus n. Okay, so if you were to define those objects and worked out all the commutators and anticommutators using the commutators and anticommutators of these guys, you would find these relations eventually. So what is the... yes, thank you. So what is the constant A in this case, and what is our critical dimension? Remembering that, of course, the same thing I said yesterday is also true. We don't have to have a critical dimension if we give up Lorentz invariance in some of the directions. But let us follow the traditional route for now and ask that all directions are created equal. Then we have a critical dimension. What is it? And we can. It turns out, so I won't argue for it in great detail in view of the time. I will simply show you that there is a consistent set of choices. So one thing I should mention, C, what is C, you ask? C is the central charge of both sectors, the bosonic sector, they're D bosonic fields. D fermionic fields, and it turns out that a fermion contributes a half of what a boson does in this accounting. So I'm going to argue, I'm going to compute what A is using the zero-point energy discussion that we had last time. And I simply go through and add up what the various sectors are. And so it turns out, so let me argue it this way. If, as you know, the critical dimension is 10, as you've been told, or you may even have shown it from some other method, and I'm going to show you that 10 is consistent with nice things. Let us compute the zero-point energy first. So following the logic of what we had yesterday, we have 8, because two of the directions are silent. I'm going to write down the following formula. No, not this formula, this formula. And get the following. So what have I done? I have, these are the bosons. And it turns out that the zero-point energy for these half-integer moded, so the Nirbusch-Schwarz fermions, is minus 1 over 48. And I have 8 of those guys as well. So this is the Nirbusch-Schwarz sector. And this gives me minus a half. And so this is what A will be, that total contribution to the zero-point energy, because it is the zero-point energy because it only switches on when M is 0. So it's talking about L0. Similarly, there's something going on in the Ramon sector. So there's a different calculus you must do in the Ramon sector. The bosons remain the same. They don't care. And the fermions each have plus 1 over 24. And so A is either minus a half or it's 0, depending upon the sector. And we'll be doing something, if not with me, perhaps with other courses. You'll see that when you have more interesting things going on, more sectors, with different modings, perhaps, for the bosons and fermions, not just what we're doing now, which is implicitly Neumann-Neumann on an open string. These set, you can have some of the directions doing different things. So rather than have all eight with integer-moded bosons and half-integer-moded fermions, you might have some sectors where there are some of them have different modings. And then you get different zero-point energies, which will correspond, ultimately, to different structures of fields, space-time fields, coming from different sectors of the theory. So we will talk about that in more detail. But right now, this is just the construction of the basic open string with Neumann-Neumann boundary conditions. So there's a formula which is useful to remember, which is when you're stuck on a desert island and you want to compute things like this, you want to remember what the zero-point energy is. So you either go back and compute Casimir energies on a cylinder in general and do very fancy things, which would be impressive and would certainly pass the time, or you remember that the zero-point energy formula looks like this. So it's a half h-bar omega. That's what they always look like. H-bar is 1, so it's a half omega for a boson, and it's for a fermion, it's a minus a half h-bar omega. And omega is 1 over 24 minus, well, there's various ways of writing this, but here's one. And theta is 0 if it's integer modes. Integer modes. And it's a half if it's half integer. So that will give you the minus 1 over 48, the 1 over 24, and the minus 1 over 24, for example. Okay, so what we're going to do now is just briefly remind ourselves of that which we reminded ourselves yesterday, which is how to construct some of the space-time fields. So one of the things that we'd like to do is, of course, look at the content of L0 in order to correlate L0 with the space-time mass formula. It's going to work exactly the same way because we will have some pieces, some zero-mode pieces coming out which give us the m squared, and we'll be asking that the Ls annihilate everything, so that will give us a mass formula in space-time, just as it did before for the bosonic case. So physical states, which I think I called phi yesterday, are such that they are annihilated by the LNs and the GRs, as before. And let me just focus on L0, just to have a look at the structure of L0 for now. So L0, if I stick 0 into that formula, well, in view of the time, let me not write this out again with m replaced by 0. That seems a bit silly. I can just do that. So we look at L0. You can do this in the privacy of your own home later on. You look at L0. Okay, well. You look at L0. And you can see that it's looking just like we had before, some interestingly normalized number operator counting the number of alpha oscillators that I switched on and the number of psi oscillations that I switched on with a basic zero-point energy at the ground state, which is minus a half in another Schwarz sector or plus or zero in the Raman sector. And so if I took this, remembering that this is a sum over all n here, the first term, but I guess it's really the middle term, the zeroth term in this sum will give me something like alpha zero dot alpha zero, and that's going to be up to a normalization, which we can recall in a moment, that's going to be p mu, which is going to be minus m squared. So that whole thing must be zero on physical states, and so that will give us a mass squared formula. So I'm not going to write that out, it's just a couple of steps. I'll just write out the mass squared formula. So it turns out that, just to remind you from yesterday, alpha zero mu is 2 alpha prime to the half p mu for this open sector. And so we end up with m squared. So L0 gives us n squared is equal to 1 over alpha primed sum alpha minus n alpha n plus r psi minus r psi r. And it's either minus a half or zero, depending. So these count. The oscillations. Okay, so that's our mass formula. And so now we're ready to construct massless states to start out with. And you can immediately see that we're going to get massless states from two sectors, the Raman sector and the Noether-Schwarz sector. And from the Noether-Schwarz sector, it is interesting to note, for example, actually from both sectors, it is interesting to note that it's the fermions, it's the worksheet fermions that are going to do the interesting stuff for us to start out with. For example, here, it's going to be psi plus a half. It's going to be psi minus a half, which has energy, plus a half, which is going to have mass squared equals zero. Let me do that a little bit more carefully. And yes, I am ignoring the fact that before I excite anything, I have a tachyon with mass squared minus 1 over 2 alpha prime. So let me list everything properly and talk about what we need to do to proceed. So, first of all, so I have a zero mode. Okay, so I can endow my vacuum with some momentum. Okay, so so the basic thing to do is just have something with some momentum, which I'll call K. So that's my vacuum, where p mu is k mu. Okay, and so that thing I go through and I measure its mass. I have no oscillators excited, so I have that m squared is equal to minus 1 over 2 k alpha prime. Okay, so this is the famous tachyon, which will leave the building shortly. Okay, then I can excite with psi minus a half mu. And this is going to give me something that has mass squared 0, which of course we know is the photon. So the tachyon sometimes is called T. Let me say T of x to remind you it's a space-time field. And then I have a mu x, which we'll call the photon. So the technology, which I'm not spending too much time on, which is readable in many sources, the technology that that we're using is, of course, to discover this gauge, that this field comes with a gauge invariance, is what I said before. I can construct various states by acting with the modes, and then I constrain them to be physical with this set of constraints. And what I find is that I can construct extra states which are called null states, which correspond to being able to add, given this state, I can add another state to it, which does not give me anything new in terms of the space-time physics, and so corresponds in space-time to something analogous to a gauge transformation. I'm not going to go through that, otherwise we'll never get anywhere with the whole story. So this is something that should, if it troubles you, please do some of the extra reading. So I could continue at higher mass levels and make higher mass fields, but I'm not going to do that. Let's just look at the zero mass things for a moment. So I can define a polarization for this as well by just having some polarization vectors soaked in here as well for full generality. Let me not do that either. But what I wanted to say is that this goes through very similarly to what we did with the bosonic case. I can also consistently choose, in this sort of clumsy way of doing things, I can consistently choose that the zero and one directions are the ones that don't contribute. That has the beauty of, again, allowing us not to worry about the ghosts, and gives us the right number of independent degrees of freedom for a photon in, in 10 dimensions, which is 8. And so that's sort of structurally very similar to what we had previously. So then I need to tell you about this thing called the GSO projection, which is simply a, at this level, is a consistent, just looks to be a consistent projection you can do on the structure of the theory, which happily achieves something nice in space-time, and that is supersymmetry. So there's a longer conformal field theory story as to why this projection is very natural in the full conformal field theory language. But I'll just do it at the level of defining it and showing that it's nice, at least at the massless level. So the GSO projection . So what is this? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm simply going to go around, and everything I build, I'm going to count its fermion number. And so I'm going to define the operator which goes around and simply counts minus 1 to the f. So f is the fermion number. And so and then, for reasons that will look a bit strange, we're going to assign, there's an overall convention of how I define who gets minus 1 to start out with. And I'm actually going to assign minus 1 to the f equals minus 1 to the vacuum. Perhaps annoyingly, but I can do that. And then the GSO projection is to simply project the entire spectrum onto even fermion number. Now, at the level we're working here, this is a rather clumsy thing to do because we're working level by level, etc. So as I said, if you did it in the full conformal field theory in a sensible way and constructed an appropriate family of vertex operators that did that for you, that would be the way to do it. But right now, I'm just simply declaring that if I did it state by state, this is a sensible thing to do. And that subsector will actually have space-time supersymmetry. So there's a story, long story, which I apologize that I'm leaving out, which will give us a space-time supersymmetry. So I will show you that we at least have, at the Masters level, all the pieces we need for space-time supersymmetry. So right now, all we've done is another Schwartz sector, so you can see what's going to happen. The tachyon will be projected out according to our conventions. Our physical choice about what we're calling fermion number even, fermion number odd, and the photon will survive. So the other thing I want to do, given that we're, so I'm just going to classify states in space-time according to, so I should have said this earlier, according to the SO8 subgroup of the 10-dimensional Lorentz, otherwise known as the little group. Okay, so I'll be doing this in all sectors in a moment. So this, how you transform under SO8 will be a nice way of classifying everything. And you can see that this is, well, it's a vector, and it's in the 8. And so that's called the 8 little v of SO8. So we're going to find a bunch of other 8s in a minute. Everyone happy? Yes? Yes. Well, without it, you you have a you just sprinkled a bunch of space-time fermions in with what we found last time, so you still have, for example, the the tachyon, etc. We're looking for a space-time supersymmetric theory, and this is what it will amount to. So you can either do the projection and then go through and realize that you now have everything left falls into nice space-time supersymmetric multiplets, or you could actually go the other way and impose space-time supersymmetry and see what condition it imposes in the Wheelsheet theory, and you'll find that it implies the GSO projection. Now, there are other bosonic 10-dimensional theories of interest, the type 0 theories, which have a different kind of GSO projection. I won't be talking about those due to lack of time, but I'm pretty sure Seiberg will be. And so those are closed string theories, which we haven't got to yet in this language, for which you can do an independent GSO projection on left and right moving, essentially. And that I'm not sure what the best name for it would be. And that will, that will define the type 0 theories, which are also interesting. Okay. Say again? Indeed, yes. So we're only doing it for space-time supersymmetry. Excuse me? I'm sorry, several of you are talking at once. Who wants to go first? Did you ask a I'm sorry, I have the lights in my eyes, so I... Sure. This is one way to deal with it. Yeah. What were you? Okay. Sorry, I thought. Sorry. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about the Ramon sector. So the Ramon sector is particularly interesting because you can see that there are in fact several ways of getting zero mass. Because in fact any one of the size. So well, here we go. The Ramon sector has psi with a zero there, and so any one of those guys will give me a massless state. So I have a degenerate vacuum, and in fact, it's degenerate in an interesting way because the psi zero sector actually satisfies the Clifford algebra, and so. This is a clue about what's going to happen. These vacua form an interesting representation, which will resemble a space-time fermion. So, so notice that the following is true. If you go back and look at the formulae that we had and you stick zero in, you have that. So up to a factor of two, this looks like the Clifford algebra. I can bring that factor of two in by simply saying if define psi zero to be something like a gamma over root two, then these ground states really do form Clifford algebra as follows. So there are two, what is it? 2 to the 10 over 2, that's 32 states. So what I want to do is study these states, but I want to grade them. I want to group them together in nice ways, which will make sense in space-time. So I'm just going to observe another nice thing, which you probably know. And that is I can build the space-time, the generators of space-time Lorentz transformations out of the gamma matrices, and hence out of the zero modes. So Lorentz can be built from gammas as follows. So I take J mu nu. So this is these are the guys that form the space-time Lorentz, which I remind you is something like this. Actually, let me not write it out. There it is, some antisymmetric generator. And it's simply built as follows. So this is probably something you may have done in a course on fermions, perhaps on supersymmetry, I'm not sure. So what we're going to do is we're going to make the analogous object inspired by this. Let's construct the following object, S mu nu, which is going to be minus I over 2 sum psi mu minus so sum over R going to make this guy. So you can see there's a 2 there because of this, 1 over root 2 here. And so this guy, this operator in the two-dimensional theory is the guy that will tell us about space-time Lorentz. And this fellow suggests to us that we work in the following nice basis. So let me, I always forget what the name of this basis is. It's one that shows up everywhere. So I'm going to work in the following basis in order to classify my states. So what I'm going to do is, looking again at just the zero modes, I'm going to construct the following fellows. I'm going to call D. And I'm basically going to take these guys in pairs. And I'll explain what these pairs morally are doing for you in a moment. So this is I equals 1 up to 4, and then D 0 plus or minus is 1 over root 2 psi 0 1 minus or plus psi 0. So I have 5 of these beasts. And what I've really done is I've simply taken 10-dimensional space-time and broken it up into 5 sets of 2 planes, and I can measure the, in each of the planes I can ask what the eigenvalue of these operators will be, and that will construct the spin of the space-time fermion. That'll help me classify the spin of the space-time fermion in this basis. I think this is called the Chevalier basis, but I'm not sure. Or Chevalier, I'm not sure. Does anyone know? Okay, guess not. Okay. So it's nice then, it's a nice way of seeing the 32 states. So the plus guys are creation operators, and the minus guys are annihilation. And then you can see that the algebra, Clifford algebra, in this basis is just something nice. And so once I've arrived at this basis with that nice algebra, the story of counting the spin of each state is a simple one. I simply have 5 numbers I need to keep track of. In the normalization I'm using, these numbers are either plus or minus a half. I'm going to call them S0, S1, S2, S3, and S4. And these guys are essentially S01, with an I here, has eigenvalue S0. And then S23, S1, etc. So that hopefully now connects in your mind this to this and to this. So these are little s's, although they've sort of grown a bit. So the si are plus or minus a half. Okay, so I can just basically make all the states by acting with d's. Okay, and I can only ever go up and up or down from plus to minus a half in each of these. So I only have 2 choices for every single one of these. So you can see the 32 states manifestly. So So since SI is either plus or minus a half, this corresponds to the 32 states. That's rather nice because we can also look at the structure of things we built out of various combinations of plus or minus a half. We can always translate it back to its spacetime and Lorentz properties through this route. So everything is manifest if you sort of sit and work through. Oh, and I guess I should also, I guess I need to say what the bottom of the ladder is. D minus acting on everything down is, of course, zero. OK, so what happens is that there's a natural grading because, let's see if we can see. Oh, did I mention the planes? So the point is that each of these spins represents just telling me what's going on, what the helicity is, if you like, in each of the five planes. And it's either plus or minus a half in our normalization. OK, so now we can talk about how these states actually look and what they do for us. So importantly, so this 32, in fact, breaks down into two natural clumps of 16. I'll call 116 and 116 primed, where somewhat arbitrarily, somewhat arbitrarily, I'll say that one has an even number of pluses and one has an odd number. And that grading arises because Lorentz actually flips an even number of signs. And so once I've broken things up this way, that will be preserved by things I do in spacetime. So then what do I have? I have a, when I construct the states, remember I must subject them to physical state conditions. And there's a natural physical state condition which comes from acting in with G0. And so remember G, among all the others, G's and L's must annihilate. And if you actually go through and you look at the physical state condition, that corresponds. So I don't have G0 up anymore. If you go and look back in your notes, you'll see that the leading part of G0 has a zero mode alpha 0 soaked up with a psi 0. So that's going to give us something non-trivial that we must consider. Why do I have a dot there? So there's a space-time Lorentz dot. And this will amount to, once you put everything in, it'll amount to a p mu psi mu 0 with some alpha primes, which we don't care about. But remembering that this thing is essentially a gamma matrix, okay, this is going to be the analog of the Dirac equation. It's going to be telling us about the on-shell condition for this state, because this will be like P slash, so it'll be a momentum space version of the Dirac equation. So that's why this physical state condition, that's how a space-time, the space-time Dirac equation will arise. And so this will amount to a constraint on how we build these states. And let me see if I can OK, what I need to do in order to show you that it constrains this is show you what is in the rest of G. So let me do that just here. So expand G0 some more. So I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep things that I need to make the whole argument, so that's why I'm moving around in a slightly random way. So expand G0 some more. What I actually have is G0 will turn out to be alpha prime to the half. There's a P0 gamma 0. There's a P1 gamma 1. So I showed you some of it already. This thing is acting, asking the state to be annihilated by that. And so what this will amount to after a bit of manipulation, just pulling out, say, a factor of gamma. Okay, so there's a factor of 2. So what I'm going to do is just ask you to fill in the step by just using the algebra of gamma matrices and picking a basis, given that this is a massless state, I'm picking a basis, which I can. I'm going to have P0 equals P1. So what I've done is I've pulled out a factor of let me just make sure I've done this right. Yes, I've picked this basis, and which I can do because I have a massless state, and then I've pulled out a factor of P. I've replaced P0 by P1. I've pulled out a factor of P0 gamma, and that's going to give me a minus gamma 1 gamma 0 piece here, which I can then exchange according to our definitions over there. Using the anticommutator, I can exchange that for S0. So I really exchange it for the operator capital S01, but when interpreted as acting on the state, it's little S0. So I hope that makes sense. I said it rather clumsily the first time round, but we're asking that this thing be 0. The physical state condition asks this to be 0, and so that's telling us that given this basis choice, S0 had better be a half. So that amounts to cutting down by half the number of states we have. So I end up with 8 and 8. These are both SO8 representations, and what I'm going to do is, because I haven't given you a convention about how I make my SO8 things, they're two different SO8 representations, and one's called the 8S and one's called the 8C, and I just for the hell of it, called one the one and the other the other. It's a convention, it doesn't matter. Okay, so then the other thing I need to do, so this was physical state condition, G0 equals 0. And then the other thing I need to do is GSO. So I need to construct the analog of the fermion number operator in this sector. And GSO amounts to, in this language, and again, it's a matter of tracing through the conventions, it amounts to asking, given that S0 is now set, it's a condition on these other guys, and it amounts to that sum, this equals 0 mod 2, that's my condition for even fermion number. And if you work this through, you'll see that it kills one of these. And in my conventions, it kills this guy. And we end up with this as the surviving state. So just to recap what we had, we constructed the Nover-Schwarz sector, and we found that after GSO projection and after physical state conditions there, we got a photon which is transforming in the 8. So this is from the Raman sector, from the Nova Short sector, which was transforming in the 8 vector of SO8 in space-time. And now we found that in the Raman sector, we have this nice structure for the zero modes which construct us space-time fermions. We have a large number of states, but some of them get thrown away. The physical state condition, the analog of the thing that gave us the fermion, the analog of the thing that gave us the photon with its gauge invariances on the Nova-Schwarz side, asks us that this guy satisfy the Dirac equation. That throws out half of the state, so it puts it on shell, if you like. And then we throw out another half because of the GSO projection. I've just told you what the convention transfer amounts to here. And so that leaves us with 8 states, which I've chosen by my internal conventions to be the 8s. So we have some spinner, and we have some vector, same number of components, both massless. This is space-time supersymmetric at the massless level. This is all we can construct in this theory. So this is the n equals, so this is n equals 1, d equals 10, it's essentially Super-Yang-Mills. It's a bit grand. It's just a fermion and a photon as super partners. Okay, so this is where we'll pick it up next time. So let me write this as the following. This is where we'll pick it up next time. So remember, we can always think of the closed string theory as a bunch of stuff moving on the left and a bunch of stuff moving on the right. And as we saw yesterday when we reviewed the bosonic string, the structure of what's on the left and right looks just like a single copy of the open string. What we will do is work with this as our starting point to construct the closed string theories rather quickly in the next lecture. And we'll construct the type 2a and type 2b closed string theories, and then proceed from there to study other properties of perturbative string theory. So are there any questions before we stop? We do have 3 minutes. Mustn't waste those minutes. Okay. Can't think of anything to say in those 3 minutes, so I guess we go. Okay. I'll buy back those 3 minutes from you in one of the other lectures. So, what's the question?
Can we define, we chose critical criterion for target space